Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Well, good morning. Thank you for joining us for Off-Site Court. The bench might look a little different today. Chief Justice O'Connor cannot be with us today, but she is participating remotely. She is watching oral arguments as they move forward. In our first case, 2019-1215, State of Ohio versus Phil Potts. For the appellant, Mr. McClabe.
Good morning, Your Honors, and good morning, Chief Justice. I understand you're watching wherever you are. May it please the court, my name is Robert McCaleb, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Delvonte Philpotts, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Public Defender. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I'd like to begin today with the facial challenge under the Second Amendment and Article 1, Section 4 of the Ohio Constitution. The statute under attack here, by banning possession of firearms by mere indictees, even for self-defense in the home, is unconstitutional under any plausible standard of review. It directly encumbers the core of the right, that is, again, defense of the home. It's completely unexampled in history. There's subsequently been a couple of enactments like this, but there's never been one like this. There had never been one like this previously. And it goes beyond new acquisitions to include a ban on even continued pre-existing possession. And the invasion is deep in this case. It's an absolute indiscriminate ban on that continued possession at any place and for any reason, and it applies without regard to individualized circumstances or any individualized determination of an individual indictee's actual dangerousness. I want to make something clear sort of at the outset. Nobody is saying, or certainly I'm not saying, that the Second Amendment is an absolute right. I don't think anybody can seriously argue that. I'm also not saying that all indictees are safe, nor am I saying that there's no way for the government constitutionally to disarm.
Doesn't that create a problem for your argument if you say that some indictees are not safe? Because you have a facial challenge, so you have to show that it's unconstitutional in all of its applications.
Yeah, so a couple of points on that. I think first, it doesn't create a problem because it is unconstitutional in all applications because it applies to all indictees who don't get any process
But that's not the way a facial challenge works, right? You have to show that that it wouldn't be constitutional applied to anyone, right?
Well, that's sometimes how it's been formulated. I think the Supreme Court, you know, that's what the United States Supreme Court said in Salerno, but it kind of walked that back in a subsequent case in Morales, saying that, you know, that it didn't really literally mean any conceivable case. And I think we kind of know that's true from certainly other Supreme Court cases where, like Heller, for instance. I mean, of course, there are certain people who can't have pistols at home. Those people are like convicted felons or mentally ill people or people who are presently intoxicated, maybe.
Speaking of that, then, what is our standard of review here?
I think the standard of review here, I think the appropriate degree of constitutional scrutiny is strict scrutiny for a case like this. I think there's an open question. You know, there's the two-step framework that certainly three members of this court applied in Weber. There's then the Texas.
There was no majority there, though.
There was no majority there, at least on that question.
There was a majority on the historical analysis.
So, and then there's the text, history, and tradition question. But I think that test, I mean, ultimately, in a case like this, it ends up being pretty similar to strict scrutiny. You're looking at, well, you know, does this protection burden something that's historically within the core of the liberty? And if it does, it has to really be extraordinarily well justified.
Not all indictees are subject to this rule, this law, correct?
Yeah, right, that's true.
I pass $100,000 of bad checks, I can still carry a gun, can't I?
Yes, you can. And I should be clear, and I hope I was clear in my briefs as well, but I would like to be clear today. Yes, it's not literally all indictees, but rather than say indictees charged with certain offenses, it does only apply to people charged with those violent offenses and with drug offenses. But
so doesn't that make it narrowly tailored?
No, I don't think it's narrowly tailored at all. First of all, there's at least 10,000 criminal cases filed just in Cuyahoga County alone every year. At least that was before coronavirus. Obviously, things are a little bit different. But the point is, this is affecting an enormous number of people because, yes, not every single one of those indictees is going to be affected by this ban. But again, you know, I'm not a statistician, but something like 66% or so of the offenses of admission to ODRC facilities are disabling offenses. So, I mean, it covers a ton of people. But I think the real problem here is that it does it indiscriminately. We don't know anything about these people besides that there's probable cause to believe that they committed one of these disabling offenses.
A violent offense.
Or a drug offense.
So if you have probable cause to believe that someone committed a violent offense, you can certainly constitutionally lock that person up and keep them in jail. The restriction here seems much less than that. Why is locking someone up okay and taking their gun away and not?
So you can lock them up. That's true. That is a potential incident of indictment. But you can only do that after a hearing where, you know, the court, the United States Supreme Court in Salerno kind of went through these factors. You have to have a hearing before a neutral and detached magistrate that's adversarial, that's counseled, where there is a finding that this is the least restrictive way to protect the community and I suppose also to ensure the person's appearance, but that's...
There isn't a hearing right here. You get a chance for a hearing if you want one, right? After the fact.
Yeah, so, right, and that is that last clause there, after the fact. That's the problem. So the government relies on RC 2923.14 to justify this statute, and so did the 8th District, but...
So your argument is the hearing should come before...
Yes, I think so. I mean, I have a lot of problems with 29.
So your real argument is
due process.
You want the process to start earlier, and yet what you're really arguing here is Second Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because I think the Second Amendment protects this right. Again, not absolutely, but it is we know now it's a fundamental individual human right.
You're suggesting is at the time of arraignment, then every defendant charged with a felony has a hearing regarding their Second Amendment rights.
Yeah, I think there's multiple ways of making this situation constitutional. I think that's the readiest and the easiest. We already are going to have a bond hearing in every single case. So it's not as if there's, there are statutory solutions here that the General Assembly would have to do things to make this statute constitutional, but if the goal, and I think this is the goal, I mean, I agree that the government has an important or even a compelling safety interest here. So if the goal is public safety, well, that goal can adequately be accomplished by having a hearing.
Mr. McCaleb, does it matter to you, or do you think it should matter, whether the offense for which someone is indicted involved a gun?
Certainly at a bond hearing, I think that would be very relevant information. But I don't think it can be dispositive, and I don't think, the statute might be a little bit more difficult to attack if it only applied to violent crimes where there was an allegation that a gun was involved. But I still don't think that would solve the problem alone, because, I mean, a gun may be involved, and yet a person, I think it is possible to imagine a situation where a person is, in fact, not too dangerous to continue possessing firearms that they acquired pre-indictment. And that's one of the things that's kind of weird about 2923.14. It proves that the General Assembly knows that not all indictees are actually too dangerous to continue possessing firearms, that some of them can do that. It just, it does it topsy-turvy. The idea is not to withdraw people's fundamental rights in the first place. So having this process that then says, well, okay, you can come back and you can ask for your rights back and we might give them to you, I don't think that's really satisfactory. And kind of, you know, going a little deeper into that statute, I mean, there's no meaningful standard. The burden is placed not on the government that's withdrawing the right, but on the holder of the right, the person whose fundamental right this is. They're the one who has to prove something. You know, it's really hard to tell from the statute what that is exactly. There's no requirement that the trial court make any factual findings. They can just deny the motion, which essentially insulates it completely from, you know, any meaningful appellate review. I mean, maybe you could, you know, there could be some extraordinary writ or something,
Can you think of some example where the legislature could enact a statute that deprives someone of a constitutional right from the indictment that would be, without due process, without hearing, would be appropriate?
So without due process and without a hearing, I think probably the General Assembly could say, well, you can continue to possess whatever firearms you possessed pre-indictment, but you can't acquire new ones. We can regulate.
How is it different? How is it different whether I can still have 17 guns as opposed to 27 guns?
Well, I think that there's something, you know, the court in, I think it's pronounced Laurent or Laurent or whatever it is, the federal case kind of on this point that the government relies on, I think discusses this, you know, pretty convincingly. The difference is there's, if I acquire a firearm and then I'm subsequently indicted, I didn't acquire the firearm in any connection to the indictment. But there's something kind of ominous about someone who knows, because if you are convicted, there's no state in the union, and of course the federal government as well, prohibits you from continuing to possess firearms because you're a convicted felon. So someone who is indicted and then thinks, boy, you know, I hope I win this case, but if I don't, I know I'm going to have to give up my firearms. I'm going to get one anyway. There's something alarming about that. There's something ominous about that that I think.
What if I'm a defendant who says, you know, they indicted me on this case, but I know I'm innocent. I know I'll be proven innocent or found not guilty. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to continue on going to gun shows and acquiring guns because that's what I like to do.
Yeah, I mean, well, as, you know, so I mean, I think that I am personally skeptical that bans on even new acquisitions by indictees are constitutional. I think we'll probably have a better sense of at least what direction the United States Supreme Court is going on this when the New York case is decided soon. I mean, I think we're going to learn a lot from that case. It's been, almost 13 years since the Supreme Court has spoken directly on this. So I am skeptical that you couldn't just say, well, look, it's my hobby to do this, and I also like to continue protecting my family. But I do think an enactment like that would be much more difficult to challenge. I think the government, or the General Assembly, rather, could do something like the way we do TPOs. You know, if they want to make this not just a bond condition, but a separate crime, you have a hearing. The government says you can't, or the court says you can't have guns anymore. And then if you do it, and you've been determined to be a person who is too dangerous to continue possessing firearms, and then you do it anyway, that's a new crime. Just the same way a violation of a TPO is itself a new crime. I think always, or at least usually, it's an M1. But also with bond conditions, you know, it's not like those are toothless. Of course, obviously, if you violate a bond condition, your bond can be revoked, or at the very least, new conditions can be imposed. But it's more than that. I think you can also, first of all, you can be held in contempt of court and then sentenced separately on that. It can be a sentencing consideration for the trial court.
If the statute didn't exist, mm-hmm, at the bond hearing arraignment, whenever, without that statute, could a court order you to turn in your guns at common law, in effect?
I mean, I think
as a part of your bond.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, Rule 46 allows for reasonable bond conditions or reasonable conditions.
Well, if the judge can do it without, you know, without any statute, then, mm-hmm, why can't the judge do it with a statute?
Well, because when the judge does it without any statute, the judge is doing it as part of an adversarial hearing. You know, so you're up there, you've got your lawyer, you potentially can, you know, you can call witnesses, you can cross-examine people. I mean, things that are fundamental parts of due process, rather than...
And those occur in the hearing that's set up here under the statute, right? It's adversarial. Cross-examination, evidence.
Sure, yeah. The problem is it happens too late. I think if we were dealing with the means of carrying something, or if we were dealing with something like the restriction in Weber that says, well, look, you can continue to possess, but you just can't use it for these few hours while you're drunk. I think something like that, probably, I'm skeptical, but I think probably a post-deprivation remedy would be okay. But when we're absolutely encumbering the core of the right, saying you simply cannot possess a firearm to defend yourself and your family because, well, we don't know, because someone found probable cause that a crime has been committed, but you can come and let us know what the reasons are why you shouldn't have your fundamental rights taken away. I don't really see how that can possibly be squared with the Constitution, with either the federal Constitution or the Ohio Constitution.
Mr. McCaleb.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that the Second Amendment allows the state to criminalize the possession of guns by non-law-abiding individuals? And would you consider the indictment status to be non-law-abiding?
I do. I see that I'm out of time, and I'm if I may answer your question.
Please.
Thank you. I do think that the state can criminalize the possession of firearms by non-law-abiding people, but I think an indictment is not sufficient to declare someone non-law-abiding, especially when we're dealing with fundamental rights here. I mean, first of all, you're innocent until proven guilty. I mean, that's.
But there's been probable cause found in the indictment process.
Yeah, there has, and that is good. But I mean, first of all, it's very easy to secure an indictment, and it still doesn't necessarily give us any information about the specific person's particular dangerousness for exercising this fundamental right. So we can say, well, look, there's probable cause to believe you've committed a crime, and so now we can engage in all these questions. Now we can ask, well, are you too dangerous to continue possessing a firearm? Are you too dangerous to be at liberty pre-trial? You know, can we put you on GPS monitoring? Things that ordinarily the government couldn't do without that probable cause determination. But the probable cause determination doesn't, it's not the end all of this. It starts the process, and it's process here that's missing. And so for those reasons, I would urge this court to reverse. I'll reserve the remainder of my time, whatever
Thank
it is.
You.
Thank you.
Mr. Fiantre-Tru.
Good morning. good morning to Madam Chief Justice. And to Associate Justices here. My name is Kevin Filiatro. I'm an Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Cuyahoga County here on behalf of the state of Ohio in this case. what we have here is a facial challenge to Revised Code Section 2923.13A2, which the General Assembly has enacted, which the triggering event in this particular instance is the grand jury indictment that has been rendered against somebody charging a violent felony offense. We're not talking about just any felony offenses here. We're talking about aggravated murder, murder, rape, aggravated arson, aggravated robbery, terrorism, and the like. This statute does not apply to everyone who's indicted with a crime in this state. And that's worth noting at the outset here when we talk about whether the General Assembly tried to tailor this regulation to determine somebody's level of dangerousness. And that's okay, what the general...
But counsel, let's say one of the offenses of rape in our, I mean, one of the offenses of violence in our statute is rape, correct? So let's say you have an allegation of acquaintance rape to people, man and woman who dated and involved in sexual intercourse, and she says, I didn't consent. It was forcible. No weapons were used whatsoever. This statute, if the defendant, if the alleged person it has a gun, would be required to turn in those guns and not possess any guns pending the indictment. Correct. Although there's no weapon involved in this case, this is a matter of consent or lack of consent. And how does the statute, how does it make sense that somebody, an indictee, would then have to give up his Second Amendment's rights in that instance?
Sure. So rape is a violent offense under the Ohio law. And whether a gun is used or not, it doesn't...
Or any weapon.
Or any weapon, correct. Doesn't change the fact that it is classified as a violent offense under the law. What that individual would lose their Second Amendment right until, and that individual has a remedy, has an immediate remedy to inquire, to petition a court to say, I'm not someone who this statute should apply to. That person can file a motion,
but why can't
to court.
As was asked Mr. McCaleb earlier, why isn't it the state's burden to say that it should not apply to this individual under these circumstances? Why is there a blanket rule that encompasses everybody, and then those individuals have to come back to court and say, hey, it shouldn't apply to me? Why can't the government say it should apply to you, and this is why?
Sure. The blanket rule applies to everybody indicted with a violent offense. So, and I would answer this by looking at other portions of that same statute. What are the triggering events for other portions of the statute? Being drug dependent? Being someone at risk of being drug dependent? Who determines that? That there's actually less, that's more of an amorphous situation than even a grand jury indictment is.
But maybe that's unconstitutional too. That's just not in front of us.
Perhaps, but it doesn't change the fact that this is the type of risky individuals that the General Assembly is talking about with these regulations regarding guns.
Why do we need this statute? I mean, these people are going to come before the court for a bond hearing. If the state's free to ask as a condition of bond that firearms be taken away, why not do these on a one individualized basis?
So the General Assembly has decided that bond restrictions are not enough of a deterrent. And
let me ask it this different, because that's similar to your other argument. I want to note the difference between Second Amendment and Article 1, Section 4 of the state constitution. They're worded differently. And in state constitution, you're allowed to bear arms for your defense and security as an Ohio citizen, correct?
Correct.
So let's say it's a drug deal gone wrong and the defendant says, I wasn't even there, but I need this gun to stay safe where I live. Why does the government have a right to take that away under the state constitution?
So under the state constitution, you're exactly right. Yeah, the wording is how you have said. That wording is not so different from what Heller decided the core of the Second Amendment protection is for law-abiding citizens to protect hearth and home. And the problem is, though, it is not an absolute right. Heller has said that. Other courts have said that. In fact, no court has said it is an absolute right. Heller said it isn't.
But the state constitution can give broader rights to citizens.
It can.
Than the federal government.
It can.
So why do I care what Heller says on this issue?
Well, with regard to this issue,
under the state constitution,
this court could decide this under state constitution. It could. There is not as much of a broad set of case law regarding state constitution as opposed to the Second Amendment, which is the main issue here. I would suggest that even under Ohio's constitution, the right isn't absolute. All right. Heller has made a distinction here in its wording that the Second Amendment protects law-abiding citizens' right to protect hearth and home. Concurrent with that, the General Assembly has decided that people indicted for violent offenses are presumed to be risky, presumed to be someone we don't want to have a gun.
Counsel?
Yes.
In making that presumption, is it possible that the state is looking at the fact that those offenses to which this statute applies are generally more serious offenses that could carry with it a longer, more serious penalty, and that persons facing that may be apt to do things that are more desperate?
Certainly, absolutely. In fact, we actually have a real life, in this sense, this is a facial challenge, I think it's worth noting. We have a real life example that happened just on October 1st in Lake County. An individual named Blake Sargi had just had his trial for double homicide. He was out on bond. He had two counts of aggravated murder. He was alerted to the fact that the jury had come up with its decision and went to the courthouse and brought a gun with him and committed suicide in the courthouse parking lot, October 1st.
Well, let's go back to Justice DeWine's question when he said, why do you need the statute? Why not individualized hearings?
With this statute, we're talking about a potential immediate need, all right? So someone who's been indicted for a violent offense is someone that a grand jury has said there's probable cause to find this person is violent.
Well, what's the immediate need? What informed the legislature? What's the legislative history that informed the legislature that this statute, there is an immediate need to take, to deprive anyone of their Second Amendment right or their constitutional right under Ohio, to deprive them of that right? Well, I mean, what's the background? Was there some study shown that indictees continue to commit crimes with guns?
Frankly, I'm not familiar with the legislative history of this particular. This was enacted in 1974.
So what's the need? What you said there's an immediate need. What is that immediate need?
The legislature has determined it's the need akin to having drug-dependent people not possess firearms, people who are at risk of being drug-dependent. This court has decided the issue of someone who's intoxicated in the home. Along those levels of risky individuals who the legislature has decided should not have guns.
But,
the same way law-abiding citizens are.
Like we analyzed in Weber, though, there is a law, and we affirm the decision that said an intoxicated person can't have a gun. That's a short-term, immediate need, not only for purposeful use of the gun, but accidental, more so, to harm him or herself or someone around. That's a small, short-term, and it doesn't take the gun away from them. It doesn't say that they can't have them. Just say you can't. It could be upstairs in your closet.
Right.
You just can't have it in your possession. This says you can't possess one, and you can't possess one for the entire time that you're under indictment until your case is resolved in your favor.
So the very first words of the statute are unless you are relieved of disability. So the statute encourages people
to. That places the burden on the defendant.
It does.
Unless you are relieved.
It does.
Justice Donnelly, go ahead.
All right, thank you. What relates to my question is do you think it's this court's obligation to question what's the need of a statute, especially in light of the fact that each of these individuals indicted has the right to have this disability relieved upon asking the court to do so?
I think that's a very good question. I don't think it's in this court's prerogative to question the need of the statute when what we're talking about. Let's talk about the standard of review here, all right? Because we've got Weber, lead opinion talks about the two-step approach. I mentioned this in my brief. The two-step approach has been utilized by nearly every single federal circuit, save the Eighth Circuit, and nearly every single court that's looked at this. I specifically look at State of Washington and the Jorgensen case that I mentioned. Two-step approach, wherein the second step would be.
Does it bother you at all that you now have a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court that seems to have rejected the two-step approach?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Does it affect what you say that you now have a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court that's rejected that two-step approach? I mean, there haven't been any cases yet, but Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett, when they were circuit court judges, firmly said that's wrong. That's,
right.
So it doesn't seem like it's a very viable test anymore, is it?
So I think it's unique when you look at the type of regulation decided in Heller as opposed to the type decided here. There's a chasm of difference between what the legislature did in Heller, which was to basically take all handguns away from all people in the District of Columbia. As opposed to here, you've got the state of Ohio legislature determining classes of individuals that it has determined legislatively are risky.
Do you think
that's a very different type of rule you're looking at? I venture to say the U.S. Supreme Court might look at the two-step approach because the first step would not answer this question.
Do you think
as it did in Heller? Go ahead.
I didn't want to cut you off either. Do you feel that the 8th District applied the right standard of review on this case?
Okay. I do. The 8th District applied the intermediate scrutiny after using the two-step approach, similar to U.S. versus Laurent, which I cite, the Eastern District of New York, which decided this issue with regard to this federal statute. State versus Jorgensen out in Washington did the same thing with its statute, which is very similar to Ohio's.
Do you agree that a majority of this court has looked at this and said we look at the historical analysis as the standard?
I understand. That's step one. And some members of this court have said step one is the only step. I understand that. Other members have said we're going to go on to step two as well.
What is the state's position? What is the standard of
the
review?
The state's position is that this court should look at this using intermediate scrutiny, as the 8th District did below, as Jorgensen did in Washington, as Laurent did in federal court.
And if we disagree with that,
then
what would we do?
If you looked at this using strict scrutiny, this statute should still survive.
And how?
Because there is a compelling state interest to protect the public from guns. I don't think anyone disputes that. No one. This statute is narrowly tailored to satisfy that need because it only applies to people indicted with violent felonies, and it gives that person a personal remedy to request relief from the statute. There's nothing in case law that says a government can't presume someone is dangerous based on a triggering event. In this case, the trigger event.
But is it narrowly tailored if really at the bond or arraignment hearing, this type of a hearing could be engaged in so that a hearing officer could make that independent determination then, so it isn't just an automatic, and then it's the burden of the defendant to fight the government?
So I that would be narrowly tailored, but I don't think it needs to be that narrowly tailored because the grand jury finding of someone having committed, let's say, an aggravated murder is a triggering event to find someone's dangerous. They're dangerous now. They're not dangerous a month from now after arraignment. They're dangerous now.
But the person might be found not guilty of the aggravated murder.
They might.
So that person suddenly becomes not dangerous?
There's a presumption of innocence.
There is, and I would encourage this court to look at what U.S. versus Laurent talked about with presumption of innocence. That is a trial right. That is not a right that affects what the government can do with regard to personal freedoms such as bond restrictions, etc.
Mr. Philiatrot, at the risk of injecting a little confusion, am I correct in civil stalking protection orders that at the initial order before the hearing, the trial court can order the confiscation of firearms, at least using federal law?
I believe it can. I believe that would be under a totally separate statute than the one.
But it's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter.
Mm-hmm.
And what would be similar in the underlying rationale for allowing that to happen to what we're talking about with the statute in question here?
Sure. The rationale would be there's been a showing that someone is dangerous, that someone is posing a threat to somebody else. And Heller does not protect that person's right to own a gun. It doesn't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've used your time, but we'll give you a minute.
Thank you very much. So just a couple of brief points on rebuttal then. I want to talk about something at the core of the government's argument. The government supposes that indictees as an undifferentiated class are simply too dangerous to be allowed to exercise their fundamental constitutional rights. But it supposes this only because it wishes to believe it. It hasn't actually offered any evidence in support of that belief, and I don't think any evidence can be offered in support of that belief as to indictees as a whole. If nobody, to your point, Justice Stewart, if nobody had ever been found guilty of the crimes they were charged with, I think I would have a much more difficult argument. But to simply assume that an entire class of people, based on a fairly routine, fairly quick, non-exhaustive process, can have their fundamental rights forfeited, simply incompatible with the Constitution. And I do just want to correct, if I may extremely briefly, an issue with 2923.14. It's not immediate. I mean, yes, of course, you could probably file the motion immediately, but one of the most important things the trial court has to consider is whether the person has led a law-abiding life since release.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes the argument. We'll take it under advisement, and you'll get a decision. Thank you so much.